Palm Beach County has a new school superintendent, a man with no experience in the classroom. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Mike Burke has been with the school district for years, but as the CFO, what does he plan for the district and how long will he want to be on the job? Also,
most of us don't realize that politics plays so much of a role in what happens in your life, and you need to know that.
There's a new exhibit focusing on the life of a longtime public servant in South Florida. We spoke with County Commissioner Barbara Jordan about her life spent in community service. And finally, the Florida Panthers head coach quit last week, embroiled in a controversy that he ignored allegations of sexual assault when coaching in Chicago. We'll share the details. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. It's an interesting time to lead a school district, especially in Florida. There are fights over mask mandates, problems with teacher shortages, and politics is seeping into the classroom. Palm Beach County Schools have a new superintendent. The district's former chief finance officer, Mike Burke, has been filling the role as interim for the past few months before taking the role on permanently. We spoke with him last week about those fights, problems, and politics, and his plans for the district. You've been working in the school district now for 23 years, but I want to know, why did you want this position? Why did you take it?
This was actually a goal of mine, and I wasn't sure it was going to happen. I'd kind of resigned myself that I'd probably retire as CFO, but I've been working 31 years total in education. I did 8 years in Broward County before moving to Palm Beach. And, you know, I've worked in Palm Beach County. I'd worked for 7 superintendents. I'd been CFO, you know, for 15 years. I'd been chief operating officer on top of CFO for 4 years. And then I was also chief negotiator for about 4 years. And I felt like I had a pretty good handle on the operations of the district. And then I've been fortunate to work with superintendents that would like include me in a lot of the academic conversations, mainly because there's always almost, you know, there's a financial impact in pretty much everything we do. So I was just kind of, you know, always working to try to get ahead. And I kind of aspired to, I'd like to have my own shot, you know, at trying to run the district. And fortunately, I'm now getting that opportunity.
And as you said, I mean, you've held a series of different positions, your role of budget director, chief financial officer, chief operating officer. But one of the things people have said is, well, not a lot of experience in the classroom. Is that a fair critique? Do you think you need to have that?
You know, I think it's something I'm actively working to kind of overcome. I do think, you know, we're a $4 billion plus enterprise with over 22,000 employees, and having worked, you know, at the district at a high level for so long, you know, there's a lot of decisions that have to be made. There's a lot of things that it takes to just run this district every day that really, you know, being a teacher in a classroom would not have prepared me for. I think some of my experiences actually have prepared me more for what it takes to kind of sit in this chair. But, you know, after saying that, I will tell you, not being the traditional candidate coming from the academic side of the house, I really value the perspective of our school principals, our teachers, and my other folks on the team, you know, my leadership team. I have a chief academic officer. I have a deputy superintendent. They have gone through the ranks, you know, from teacher to principal supervisor and up. And, you know, their opinions carry a lot of weight for me. I think I'm able to get perspectives from across the district and get input and then kind of, you know, evaluate that and analyze it and then make my best recommendation.
You have had the chance to spend some time in a classroom, though, you know, this past month. And I'm wondering what you gathered from that experience.
That was just, I would tell you, I was a little apprehensive going in because I had never really been a substitute teacher or a teacher. It turned out to be a great day. I did the whole day. I had some help, I will tell you. So I did fourth grade math, and I was fortunate to have a math resource teacher that pushed into the class with me. And then we broke the kids into small groups, and we rotated the small group instruction. And it was a little shaky the first 15 minutes or so, because I realized that the way we teach long division or and remainders and all of that has changed considerably since I was in fourth grade. But the math coach got me up to speed. They use this area model method where you draw a square and a box. And after I did a couple, I got the hang of it, and the kids were just great. I was in a dual language school where they teach, you know, 1 week in Spanish, 1 week in English. And I was just really impressed with how polite the students were and how kind they were to each other. I had some students that spoke no English. So one of their peers, one of their friends would jump in and to the role of interpreter and help me out on occasion. And I just thought that was really kind of a cool thing to see. And, you know, you hear some of the negative things out there in the world, but when you get to spend time, a full day with multiple fourth grade classes of little kids and get to go to recess with them and take them to lunch and all that, I was just really impressed. And it kind of gave me a fresh perspective on, you know, the good things we're doing and why our jobs are so important.
So you were in the role of interim superintendent for 3 months before you got the permanent job. What are your priorities for this district? In those first few months of the job, the first year of the job, what's most important for you?
Yeah. So, I mean, the first priority, you know, I became interim right before we started a new school year. So just getting the schools open and up and running, that was the first job at hand. That went smoothly. The challenges of COVID are still with us, unfortunately, and we have to navigate that. But now, you know, in the permanent role, I want to kind of move beyond that and start doing some, you know, go forward, you know, past COVID. We've got our work cut out for us. You know, we have suffered a lot of unfinished learning, both academic and social emotional. So I'm going to be working hard on, we have the benefit of the federal American Rescue Plan dollars, and we're developing a plan on to make the best use of those resources to help our kids get back on track and get them the services and the supports they need.
You know,
so we're working on that.
I wanted to jump in though, because you talked about wanting to get past COVID, and well, I mean, it's the thing we all want to, but it may be around for a little while. And you know, it's an interesting time right now because we see school districts in Florida right now dealing with mass mandates. But just look at the district below you, Broward Schools, easing their mass mandates for high school students. They're still mandatory for elementary and middle school students. Where's Palm Beach County right now? Where's the district on masks? And where do you see that going?
So I've been working with some of our medical professionals in the community. And we developed metrics to guide that decision. You know, we would like to get back to a mask opt-out when it's safe to do so. So the doctors have kind of helped me with that. And we came up with basically three criteria. The first was that the vaccine would be available to kids age 5 to 11. And then the next two metrics were, we needed to get to a positivity rate below 8% and sustain that for 4 weeks. And we've met that mark. And then the one that's more difficult to reach is we want to get cases per 100,000 down to the moderate level, which kind of shows you the risk of transmission in the community. And the moderate level means less than 50 cases per 100,000. And I'm waiting for today's report, but as of last Friday, we were at about 71 cases per 100,000. But that was down considerably from like 160 or so not too long ago. So everything's trending in the right direction. Now, the doctors I've worked with have asked that we sustain these once we get to the kind of that moderate transmission risk zone, that we sustain those metrics for 4 weeks before that we would ease up on the mask mandate.
And you know how political this has become. And there are parents out there who do not want their kids masked. What is the message to them, and how do you deal with that?
Well, my message is just, you know, hang in there. I think we're getting close. I'm going to meet with the doctors again next Wednesday. And, you know, we're just trying to keep people safe. The vaccine availability, and we're not talking about any vaccine mandate. I don't think you're going to see that in our state. But we do just want it to be available for those families that feel like that's a nice safeguard for them, for not just a child, but for maybe family members that may be immune compromised. Hopefully we'll not have some type of surge or new variant that disrupts everything again. And if they'll hang in there a little bit longer, I think we'll be able to ease up.
And interesting enough, you know, with this mask mandate, the battles that districts have had with the state, you know, the Florida Department of Education stripped local school boards of federal aid. First, they take away money from the school boards. And then when the federal government, the Biden administration said, we'll cover that, they took that money away. And now Biden is suing them. Is there a concern that if you keep pressing the governor and this administration in Tallahassee, they're just going to keep pushing back and make life harder for you?
Well, this issue with the federal money, it kind of defies, you know, logic. The federal law is pretty clear. You know, like we receive Title I dollars, you know, to provide additional supports to like our highest need schools. And we are forbidden, and the state's forbidden from pulling back existing state or local resources, basically to mitigate the positive effect of those federal dollars. So that same law applies. And so what the, you know, I think the Biden administration and what the U.S. Department of Education has been pretty clear with the state that when they try to do that, when they're pulling now back federal dollars or more, I'm sorry, they're pulling back more state dollars to offset the federal funds, that they're breaking the law. So, you know, I think ultimately the U.S. DOE is on solid ground, and the state's probably going to have to return those dollars.
I'm speaking with Palm Beach County School Superintendent Mike Burke. He's been filling the role as interim for the past few months and is now on the job permanently. We're talking about his plans for the district, and you can find more about this story and about him on our social media at WLRN Sundial. When it comes to staff and teachers, do we know how many of the staff and teachers are vaccinated?
You know, I've been encouraging people all along to take advantage of the vaccine. I think it's our best defense and our best hope to trying to get back to normal. We have not done a mandate in Palm Beach County. Our numbers, the last number I had was in about the 60% range of the number of employees we believe are vaccinated. That measure may not be perfect. I'd heard that some of the data might be missing from people who were vaccinated very early on in the process. I'm not 100% sure on that. But we continue to make the vaccine available for people who would like it. We've promoted it. We've worked with our local healthcare district to have their mobile vaccine van go out to our high schools for eligible students if they want to take advantage of that. And their parent had to be present. You know, we don't do it without the parent being physically there with them. But, you know, I just keep promoting it. I'd hope everyone would take advantage of it, because I think it's proven that even with this Delta variant, that the people most heavily impacted and that were going to the hospital were those who were not vaccinated.
You know, you're getting the opportunity to speak with teachers and principals now that you're leading the district. And I'm wondering, what are they telling you about people's mental health, the students and the teachers? Because the past year and a half has taken a toll on everybody. How are they doing? How's everybody reacting?
You're absolutely right. I think it has taken a toll. The positive side, what I've noticed, is that there's a new appreciation for just being on our campuses. After having shifted to distance learning for 18 months, you know, about 35% of our students had been home for that whole duration. And what I see from both the students and the teachers is that they enjoy being on campus. And now I think they realize that's the best place to be, best place to learn. So that's the positive side. On the downside, I will say this whole experience has been very tough on everyone. Even the teachers, you know, wearing a mask all day long, that's not necessarily pleasant, but they're doing it, you know, to try to keep everyone safe. You know, people are tired. I think it's just been tough. We recently, our school board approved $1,000 bonus to all of our employees to just kind of recognize that they've gone above and beyond and worked hard. And it's not enough, but at least it's something that to show a little appreciation. We have great employees in our district. They always rise to the challenge. Our principals find a way to make things work. You know, we were able to do our graduations last spring. But yeah, I'm hoping things get better, because it would be hard to sustain this level of effort indefinitely.
And you talk about the kids are happy to be back in class. Do the teachers feel safe? Are they happy to be back in the classroom?
I believe so. We've tried to do everything we can to make them feel safe. We've got MERV 13 air filters in all of our schools, which is the best quality. We've added 13,000 HEPA air purifiers. So there's an air purification unit in every one of our classrooms. We were encouraging to get vaccinated and now to get boosters. So I believe they are, happy to be back in the classroom.
I wanted to ask
the ones I've seen up close and personal. They're focused on the kids. They're focused on teaching and learning.
Student enrollment is down. And we've seen this, from the pandemic. A lot of kids didn't come back to school. Now, some transferred out of state or went to a private school or homeschool, but there are a lot that just disappeared. That could affect the district financially. But what's happening right now in Palm Beach County with that?
We are down over 7,000 students from pre-pandemic enrollment. We still have over almost 190,000 students if you include the charter school students. So we're still a very large district. We have adjusted our staffing based on that enrollment decline. Last year, we were able to kind of hold the schools harmless because the state did the same for us. They never adjusted our funding last year to true enrollment. This year, we are being funded on the students we serve. And so we have kind of had to ramp back staffing at some of our schools. And, I'm hoping it looks like most of those students have turned up either in home education or virtual education. And, as the pandemic, if we continue to trend in the right direction and it subsides, I'm optimistic that maybe some of those students will return to our schools.
And even with the drop in enrollment, and this is not a local issue, this is a national issue. We've seen a teacher shortage, but it's pretty profound in Florida. And in Palm Beach County, it's pretty bad. What's happening right now?
Well, we've got over 300 teacher vacancies, and that's against a workforce of nearly 13,000. So we're not doing too bad with the teachers. We have hired over 1,600 teachers this year that we were able to hire. We did see more resignations and retirements with the pandemic. And we'd certainly like to fill those remaining 300 teachers. My biggest concern right now is bus drivers. We're down over 150 bus drivers, and that is making it very difficult to fulfill our obligations in a timely manner.
How are you getting around that?
Well, we're doing the best we can. It's not ideal, but we're using our mechanics. We're paying them overtime to drive school buses and then stay late and help do the repairs. A lot of the transportation support personnel that work in across our 6 bus depots are former drivers, so that we're putting them back behind the wheel. And then we're actively recruiting new bus drivers, and we are offering $1,000 recruitment incentive to any new bus driver that comes and joins us.
And that too is not a local issue. That is a national problem right now, getting bus drivers. One of the things I found interesting, and we talked about this on the program, is that your position, the superintendent, it's become a really challenging position to fill lately. A lot of superintendents around the country are either getting fired or they're quitting. They're walking away because the pandemic in part, but also because it's become political. And we've seen right. We've seen politics seep into this now with masks, with vaccines, with the critical race theory earlier this year. How do you approach this job, where you're going to do what you can to help the students, but you're going to feel the pressure from parents and politicians?
Yeah, I try to just focus on the former, right? We're here to serve the students, to keep them safe. I will say, you have to have a strong stomach. Being the CFO and being in charge of a $4 billion budget, making sure that's balanced every year, was some good training, right? I think that toughened me up a little bit. I just do my job. I've got a family that supports me. I've got a school board that supports me. And I think most of the community supports us. So it doesn't really bother me too much. I know we've got our critics, and I hear them out. And I hope that we can work past these issues and that we'll, keep things peaceful and all kind of rally around that we're all here. We should all have the kids' best interest at heart. And we may not always agree, but I'd like to see, a return to a higher level of decorum, if possible, in our board meetings. But it's not going to sway me. It's not going to stop me from doing my job or doing what I think is best for the students.
You recently entered Florida's early retirement program, and that requires you to retire from the district in June of 2025.
Correct.
I'm wondering, so that gives you 4 years. I'm wondering, how's that going to affect, your tenure on this job?
Well, I think it's actually a positive thing. I'm at a point in my career where my kids are grown. I've got the last one's a senior in college, so I'm coming down the home stretch on the tuition and all that stuff. I've got a retirement that's going to be kind of in place. And if I have to make hard decisions, I'm going to be okay. I don't have to sweat it out as much if I was younger, earlier in my career, where if I had to change jobs or if I was a threat of losing my job may have really concerned me about just the welfare of my own family. So I feel like I'm kind of secure in that regard. And that kind of frees me up to just truly make decisions I feel are in the best interest of students. Hopefully I would like to make it till June of 2025. If I am successful in that, I will have outlasted our last four superintendents. So 4 years in this job is a pretty good run. It's a demanding job. I am working, early in the morning till late at night, many nights during the week. And I don't mind it, but I'm giving it my all. And I think after 4 years, if everything goes well, I will hopefully, advance the school district, put it in a better position than it is right now. And then I can go ahead and retire and feel like I've kind of served my community.
Mr. Burke, I'll finish with this. How are you going to measure success? What do you think about what your legacy will be?
Yeah, I've prior to being superintendent, my legacy, I think, would have been some of the referendums we've passed to improve our school facilities and to improve teacher pay. But now we've got some work to do. Only 54% of our third grade students read proficiently. And to me, that's hard to stomach. So I want to see student achievement improve dramatically, particularly we've got to do more to get kids reading on grade level by third grade, because if they don't, it just gets harder from there. It's very hard to catch them up. And we do it, and our secondary schools do an amazing job. But I'm going to look, we're going to determine some key academic measures. We're going to follow those. That's the ultimate measure of the job we're doing. And then beyond that, I really would like to see students have a connection to their school where there's something fun about school for them, that, if it's the band or sports or a club, that they've got some connection that really makes them enjoy going to school. Because I think once kids get invested in their own education and they have a reason to be there and they feel comfortable on the campus, a lot of these other things and the achievement will take care of themselves. And then my other thing I hope to leave is a legacy of customer service. I feel like schools now face an incredible amount of competition from either vouchers or charter schools or home education or virtual education. And I want our whole team to just remember that we do not have a monopoly on education in Palm Beach County. We need to go out of our way to make families and students feel welcome, and we need to support them throughout their whole education process.
And that was Palm Beach County Schools Superintendent Mike Burke, recently taking that job permanently. You can find out more about this story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, the Florida Panthers head coach quit after a report showed that he ignored allegations of sexual assault of a player. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the Florida Panthers are on top of the Eastern Conference. They have 8 wins and 1 loss. But today, there's very little talk about the winning. Last week, their head coach, Joel Quenneville, quit. This after a report came out that showed that he knew about sexual assault allegations made by a player of his former team, the Chicago Blackhawks. Quenneville originally denied that he knew about those allegations, but when he resigned, he apologized about the denial. We spoke with the Miami Herald's David Wilson this morning about the report, Quenneville's denial, and, of course, the future of the team. And a warning, we're going to be discussing the topic of sexual assault, so just in case if you have young ones who are listening. So let's start with what happened. Coach Joel Quenneville resigned late last week. Where was the pressure coming from? Was it from the Panthers or the NHL?
You know, we haven't gotten to talk to Bill Zito, who's the general manager, or Matthew Caldwell, who's the president of the Panthers. They put out statements, but we have not talked to them yet. It seems like it mostly probably came from the NHL at this point, although I think it was kind of a joint, like came to an understanding kind of thing. Obviously, he met with Commissioner Gary Bettman on Thursday, and then later that night resigned, and Bill Zito and Matt Caldwell were both in that meeting. So the Panthers, I have to imagine, realized they made a mistake by letting him coach Wednesday, which was a day after the initial report came out. And then about an hour before puck dropped on Wednesday, Kyle Beach, who was previously the John Doe, the accuser, the unnamed accuser in the report, did an extensive interview with the Sports Network up in Canada. And in that interview, basically, I don't have the exact quote in front of me here right now, but basically said there's no way Quenneville would not have known about the allegations. He said it was kind of an open and secret in the locker room. And so I think Panthers realized they made a mistake by letting him coach Wednesday. They wanted to let Gary Bettman kind of have his say in the situation. And then after that meeting, that was it.
And Quenneville on Wednesday, what he had said was he had denied knowing, right, that about the allegations, and then had to come back and apologize, obviously, when he quit. Let's go back to that story. Quenneville is the coach of the Chicago Blackhawks. As you mentioned, Kyle Beach, he was a former player for the team, made allegations of being sexually assaulted by then Blackhawks video coach Brad Aldrich. What were those allegations? What happened in that story?
According to the report, and I believe there's a lawsuit also filed, it was essentially that he was coerced into allowing Aldrich to give him oral sex, and I believe Aldrich also masturbated in front of him, were the two primary allegations there. And then it's worth noting Brad Aldrich, a couple of years later, gets convicted of fourth-degree sexual misconduct with a high school student when he was working as a volunteer assistant coach at a high school in Michigan.
And what happened to Kyle Beach? What's he doing now?
Kyle Beach is now playing in Germany, a lower division there. He was a first-round pick in the 2008 draft, came up to the Blackhawks. He actually never played in an NHL game. He got called up to the Blackhawks during their Stanley Cup run in 2010. So Kyle Beach was obviously at one point a really highly touted prospect. Never played in the NHL. There is theories of what, you know, there were at this point theories of, you know, did making this allegation stunt his career? Obviously, for whatever reason, did not pan out as the prospect they thought he would. Still playing, though, over in Germany.
And when the allegations were made, part of this report is that Quenneville, again, when he was coach of Chicago, what is it that he didn't want to hear it because the team was doing well and he wanted to focus on the team and he didn't care, or he just felt that it would be a distraction?
There was a meeting that the crux of Quenneville's involvement in this was from the report published on Tuesday by Chicago law firm Jenner and Block, who kind of ran the external investigation after the lawsuits were filed in the summer. And there was a meeting on the day the Blackhawks beat the San Jose Sharks in the Western Conference Finals to clinch their spot in the Stanley Cup, a meeting with everyone who mattered in the organization, the owner, the CEO, the GM, assistant GMs, you know, all the big decision makers. And Quenneville, obviously, in that meeting, was made aware of the allegation. And again, I don't have the report in front of me right now, so I don't want to misquote him, but basically saying that Quenneville, you know, essentially said, like, this is not a good time. You know, he didn't want to have to deal with it. From the meeting, it was kind of, the decision was made basically that non-hockey personnel should deal with it. So, you know, the CEOs of the team, you know, like the business end of the organization. And obviously they did nothing about it. I think for Quenneville, you know, the rationale that these guys have is we passed the buck to someone else. No one else did anything about it. But at the same time, Brad Aldrich stayed with the team through the end of the Stanley Cup playoffs. He was part of their championship celebrations. He got his day with the Stanley Cup. And then was allowed to quietly resign after the season when he was presented with the choice to either do that or face an internal investigation. So Quenneville, obviously, you know, he does not have the final say on who's fired and all that, but he was in a position where he could have basically sent this guy away from the team, and he didn't.
And the team is doing extremely well.
Yeah, they took their first loss, actually, in a shootout on Saturday, but had started 8-0. Was only the seventh team in NHL history to start 8-0.
All right. Well, how is the team feeling right now with all of this happening and still being successful? What's going on with them?
You know, they were obviously hurt, basically, I guess is the way to describe it. You know, partially because, you know, Quenneville, you know, this is the guy with the second most wins in NHL history. Like, won 3 Stanley Cups in Chicago, came here to Florida to kind of hopefully turn this team around. So, you know, they feel like they're missing a really important part of what made them great. But I thought Aaron Ekblad, who's a star defenseman for the team, spoke. He was I think he was the first player to speak on Friday after Quenneville resigned. And, you know, he got asked, like, does this change how you feel about Coach Q, which is what they call him? And he basically said, like, I don't know how I feel right now. You know, I think they at least the guys we've talked to about this specifically, I think, you know, they're obviously it's you know, it's like being disappointed to find out your father did something wrong, right? Like they really come to respect him, and you find out that he was involved in some way in this cover up. I think they're all hurt to know that a guy that they really care about and really respect was involved in that. And obviously, it hurts the team, but everyone is saying the right things about you know, that this was the right decision to be made.
David, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
Of course, thanks again.
That was the Miami Herald's David Wilson. You can find a link to his reporting on this story with the Florida Panthers. It's on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, Florida Memorial University is honoring a former commissioner for her 50 years of public service. We'll hear from her next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Florida Memorial University is highlighting a woman who served South Florida for 50 years. The historically black university is honoring former Miami-Dade County Commissioner Barbara Jordan with an exhibit. She also received an honorary doctorate from the school. Now, the exhibit's open to the public for at least a year. We spoke with her last week about what this honor means to her. We also talked with Cherie Gilbert. She's the Director of Communications and Marketing for the university. Ms. Jordan, I want to start with you. I wondered what it was like for you walking into the exhibit and you see your life and your career on display.
It was amazing. I had no idea they would do such a wonderful job. You know, I really did not want it to be boring, just have a room full of plaques, because there were close to 400 plaques and awards that I received, and how creative they were and thoughtful they were. And I really appreciated that. And the thing was, I kept trying to get in the room because I wanted to see it, and they wouldn't allow it. They wouldn't allow it. So until after the program and we cut the ribbon, that was my first sight, and it was beautiful.
Is there a moment in your career, in your life, that you're most proud of that's in the exhibit?
Probably the Greater Miami Service Corps. You see little trinkets from there, awards from there. My cap when I started the Corps and would go travel with the kids and staff across the country with other Corps programs. And the reason that program touches me so much is because it's taking the life of young people who may have made a mistake in their life and dropped out of high school. And it's giving them a second chance to learn a skill as well as go back to school. And at the end of their service, which they call community service, for 6 hours a day, and then they go to school for another 2 hours in one day. And at the end of their service, they receive an award, either to go to college, a college of their choice, which was up to $5,000, or to get a stipend so they can get a car or an apartment for $2,500. That to me, out of all of my 50 years in community service and serving the community, is the most rewarding program that I've been a part of.
Very lovely. Cherie, you were part of putting this exhibit together from start to finish. And I'm wondering, you know, why was it important for the university to have this exhibit now?
Well, definitely an honor to pay tribute to Commissioner Barbara Jordan. She's dedicated her life to public service, so we found it only fitting that the collection be named after her. And the title of the collection is Labor, Learning, Leadership, and Legacy. And she's absolutely right. We got so many calls of her wanting to see it before we unveiled it, and rightfully so. But we told her, hold off, you know, it'll be worth the wait. We just want to make sure that it's done right, truly paying tribute to a legend in our community, for sure. There's so many great facets of the exhibit. It's just hard to put into words, but when you walk in, you can just feel the spirit and the legacy that we are portraying in recognition of Commissioner Jordan. Just, it's definitely a sight to see.
You know, Ms. Jordan, you have a history with the university, and I'm wondering, why did you choose them to tell your story?
Well, because I graduated from an HBCU, from a historically black college and university, Morris Brown College in Atlanta. And we need to make sure that we do everything to call attention to how important HBCUs are in our community. They save so many of our young people who don't have an opportunity to go to other schools, because HBCUs work with them and get them ready and primed to be successful. And I am just so grateful that the institution is there and that I had the honor of working with them from the beginning of my tenure as a commissioner. I received, and it's exhibited there also, an honorary doctorate from Florida Memorial University. And that was the first thing that I saw when I walked in with the light, was this exhibit with the robe and the doctorate hood, as well as the degree. So I'm very proud of that.
That's a good way to start it, definitely. Cherie, how did this all start? Where did the process begin? Like, whose idea was it? And I'm wondering how those conversations even started to get this going.
Well, it was a conversation from our leadership, Dr. Hardrick and our VP of Advancement, Corey Witherspoon, and, of course, Commissioner Barbara Jordan. To also mention, Commissioner Jordan helped secure $5 million to finish our wellness center in 2016. She also delivered the commencement address to one of our largest graduating classes. And like she mentioned, we did give her an honorary doctorate. So we only thought that it was rightfully so to have her exhibit here. So the conversation started with leadership. Like I mentioned, Dr. Hardrick envisioned this exhibit. So it started probably a year ago. And so we worked with Imani, and we worked with Commissioner Jordan's sister, to really display her life story and to make sure that it was captivating to not only her, but the audience that poured in to see the exhibit.
So, Ms. Jordan, my understanding is that part of the exhibit, there's a collection of letters that that you had between you and your late husband, Eddie Jordan. And tell us a little bit about that. What can we expect to see?
I was so touched because Imani came to visit with me, and I showed her the yearbooks from my college days, and my husband and I, and of course my boyfriend at the time, had reserved a page in our yearbooks, each of our yearbooks, for us to write on. And so that was what was exhibited there, the page that I dedicated to him and the page that he dedicated to me. And of course, that was where everybody spent their time. Reading that. So, you know, and the fact that I had his sister and his brother there, and of course, both of us graduating from Morris Brown, and they had an enlarged version of our degrees hanging up there, they felt very emotional you know, going through the whole exhibit and seeing that. And of course, my sisters and brothers seeing the family pictures, you know, all of that made a difference. So I gave it a personal touch that I am so grateful for.
I wondered, you know, how, you know, for you, how you remember Eddie and the role that he played in your career.
Oh, my goodness. Eddie was one of the most generous people that you want to find, and always put others before himself, and me and our family especially. And every time you're going to make me emotional, because there's not a day go by that I don't look over and I feel that I can feel his presence. And whenever I had a campaign, he knew where every yard sign was.
Mm.
Because he put them out and he'd get upset when they disappeared. You know, I tell you, he was amazing. And I just know he enjoyed going with me to various events. And I just wish he was here to share this exhibit with me as well.
Mm. I'm speaking with former Commissioner Barbara Jordan. She's being honored with an exhibit at Florida Memorial University highlighting her life and 50 years in public service. We're also talking with Cherie Gilbert. She's the Director of Communications and Marketing at the university. Now, the exhibit is open to the public and will continue to be open for at least a year. And you can find more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. You know, Ms. Jordan, you spent 50 years in public service, and I wondered, is that what you always wanted to do?
You know, I really did not know. It's like things happen by happenstance. And I was on at the point where I had signed up to retire, because my husband had already retired. And when Betty Ferguson retired, she asked me if I would be interested in running since I was retiring. And having worked with her as an assistant county manager and knowing that I lived in the same district and knew the area, you know, I was thrilled that I was being offered that opportunity. And I told her the only way I would run is if she backed me. That to me would have made it a shoo-in. And so in spite of the competition, we were able to do it. But I do want to add that one more thing that Florida Memorial is doing that I think puts a special touch on the exhibit. They honored me that day with naming the fact that they were making it a master class.
Mm.
And by doing that, students who are in the areas or field related to law or politics or communications, once a month, they would invite someone to come in and speak. And of course, I would kick it off initially. But I just thought that was a wonderful tribute to have students come in and ask questions and listen to various politicians and speakers that would be invited to the exhibit.
Mm. Cherie, tell me about that masterclass and the idea behind it.
Well, definitely we want our students, we have a lot of law and government students here, so we wanted them to gain access to a legend in our community. We wanted them to know about her life story, and so we wanted to not only have the exhibit, but also have a practical experience that we can give to the students through this masterclass. So as Commissioner Barbara Jordan stated, we will have her kick it off, and we will invite other dignitaries throughout the community. I know the focus of the masterclass will be policy and implementing policies and what that looks like. So we're excited to offer that to our students, and we should be offering that starting in the spring.
Mm. You know, Ms. Jordan, she's talking about what the class is going to focus on policy, and it's going to look at politics from a very unique perspective. What do you think the community often gets wrong or doesn't understand about politics?
I don't think the community understands how politics impacts their everyday life. A simple thing like turning on the water in your home. Recognizing that there are people like me sitting on the commission making a decision about how much that costs and the quality, and making sure that things are done in the community, developing homes, housing, building, you know, everything in politics impacts the community. And most of us spend our everyday lives just trying to get through the day and don't realize that politics plays so much of a role in your decision and what happens in your life. And you need to know that. And I'm glad that it's starting with a master class, because students can then learn about how politics impact their lives. They then can share that with their parents, with their siblings, so that we can become much more educated and try and influence those decisions that we know are not going to be good decisions for our community, or encourage those decisions that are going to be good.
So you think about those young people taking that class and starting their lives. If they're interested in making public service their career, what advice do you give them?
Get to know your politicians. If they're interested in trying to make politics their career, get to know who represents you, what they do, what it's all about. What's the difference between a municipality, metropolitan Miami-Dade County, and a municipality like the city of Miami? Most residents don't know the difference. They don't. They don't realize that we have 34, 35 individual municipalities, and that the umbrella over most of that is Miami-Dade County, and how they tie into one another. So get to know your politician, your local elected officials, and start from there, even with your city representation.
And, you know, I think about that too, like how many of us even know who our lawmakers are, whether on a local level or state level, or sometimes even on a federal level. But what do you tell them? Where should they start, you know, so they can find that out?
Well, start with your local community. You know, who is it that's a part of your council? And meeting with them, going to meetings, so they can learn about what happened in those meetings. Because what happened in those meetings, sometimes you can impact the difference. They also need to learn that there is another part that influenced the elected officials. They can learn about, of course, lobbyists and how that impacts a decision-making process. Many of us don't realize that it's not just the fact that you have someone that's been elected to your community, but you have special interest groups who want to influence those decisions. And those decisions sometimes may not be in the best interest of your community, which is why you need to stay on top of things so that you can find out, wait a minute now, is my representative going to vote for something that's going to harm my community because they're listening to people who have access? And I need access too, because I voted for this person. And they need to really exercise that power, the power of their vote.
When you look back on your career, is there one big lesson that you take from all those years of public service?
One big lesson that I take is that you have to make sure that you're doing your research, that you're looking at every aspect of the impacts on your community. And if you don't, you'll fall for anything that someone tells you. If you don't do your own research, and you don't also go out in the community and find out, where is my community on this? How is it going to impact my community? And how can I make a decision that's going to be in the best interest? But to listen to one side who may feel that they have access, and the other side who may not feel they have so much access because they work from 8 to 5. How do I get to them and find out what they feel about it and what I should do? Then make sure we're having meetings in the community that are in the evenings, where they will have access and be able to come and express their concerns and opinions.
And that was my conversation with former Commissioner Barbara Jordan. She's being honored by Florida Memorial University through an exhibit of her life, career, and legacy. You also heard from Cherie Gilbert, the Director of Communications and Marketing for the university. Again, the exhibit is open to the public, and you can find more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Also, a reminder, local elections are happening in some of South Florida's biggest cities tomorrow, and you can get all the information you need about that on our website, WLRN.org. Well, that's our program for this Monday, November 1st. Coming up tomorrow on the show, new details have surfaced, offering more clues in what could have caused the collapse of the Champlain Tower South in Surfside. The recent reports highlights neighboring construction that caused vibrations that might have led to the collapse. So we'll get the latest on that tomorrow. Plus, the University of Miami has announced its progress on improving and building of diversity, equity, and inclusion within the community, within the university community. They've hired more Black faculty. They'll be opening a Center for Global Black Studies this year. But is it enough? We're going to discuss this with university leaders. And if you're a student or a member of the university community, we want to hear from you. You can always email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Or text us, 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.